ever had a stupid question?
Well, we're here to answer it. Welcome to This Is a Stupid Question, But I'm your host, Mahnoor.
And I'm Amy, and this is a podcast where we find all our smart answers to all our stupid science questions.
And this week, we're answering the stupid science question, should we all go vegan? And we have a very special guest, Laura Young, aka Less Waste Laura, who is a climate activist, among other titles that we'll mention once we introduce her officially. But we have her on to discuss whether we should all be going vegan.
Which, yeah, I feel like it's one of those questions I constantly think about and never know the answer to. So this is going to be helpful for us too.
Exactly. But yeah, so enjoy.
So today we're talking to Laura Young, otherwise known as Less Waste Laura. She has a master's in environmental protection and management and is now a climate activist, zero waste advocate, TEDx talker, ethical influencer, and will be here today to answer our stupid questions about veganism and sustainability. So you can find Laura on Instagram at Less Waste Laura, and we're very grateful to have her here today.
So Laura, do you want to just tell us a bit more about yourself and why you decided to focus your time on activism for climate change specifically?
Absolutely. Oh, it's so nice to be with you both. Thanks for having me on. That kind of sums up me in a nutshell, but I guess a little bit more would be that I've been on this sort of environmental journey trying to think about the way that we treat the planet for a good few years now. So after school in 2014, I went to university and did geography and environmental science. And that's very much where I started to learn about the world, the way that we treat the world, some of the bad things, some of the good things, some of the solutions. And it wasn't really actually until my final year that I started to think, what am I going to do with this information? You know, you sort of learn these things and, you know, I love having friends in really niche areas of work and you think, tell me all about that. I love to hear about it. You know, I know nothing about engineering, or I know nothing about being a doctor, or I know nothing about being this, that, or the other thing. And so I just thought maybe I've got some of that information in me that people would want to know about. But actually it was on a New Year's Day walk. So 2018, 1st January, I was with friends and family away on this trip that we go on every New Year. And it's one of those days where we go on a big New Year's walk and you sort of talk about the year ahead in a really like romantic way. You know, what's your big goals for the year and what are you planning on doing? And that year it was my final year at university, and so I was like, I have no idea, I don't know what I'm doing after uni. Panic, like didn't have a job lined up, didn't have anything lined up. And so I thought I should just pick something fun to be like a little challenge, you know, set myself a New Year's resolution or something. But actually when we were going on this walk, so we were on the east coast of Scotland in a place called Ely, and it was beautiful. But as we were walking, I was kind of aware that there was like quite a lot of litter and quite a lot of rubbish on the beach. And some of it was the sort of last night's evidence, you know, like fireworks pieces or like packaging. People obviously had like bonfires on the beach and stuff. But the further we walked, the more I realized actually some of this stuff has been here longer than a night. Some of this stuff is actually quite old. My gosh, there was like tires and fishing nets and just loads of stuff. And so it was actually on that New Year's Day that I was like, okay, this is my New Year's resolution. I'm going to try to live a little lighter on the planet, try to reduce my plastic. We'd had the whole blue planet thing, so we knew how bad that was. So that really entered me into this kind of phase of my life where I thought I need to start looking at what I can do as an individual, not because I think I'm going to save the planet, but because we all have a part to play. So that's when I started this like Less Waste Laura Instagram page and across social media, because I thought, in the same way that I had these little nuggets of academic information, I was like, oh, I also have these life things that I'm trying out. You know, I've got products that I love, or I've got things that I've been learning about. And so, yeah, it was kind of over 3 years now that I've been just trying to like put out little nuggets online. But since graduating, so graduated from my degree, I then went on and did that master's. So I learned a little bit more. And since then worked as a sustainability intern with Scottish Power. So I was looking at their waste, and I was doing that kind of at the end of my master's to do a dissertation on it. And now I work for the International NGO Tier Fund. And so a lot of the work I'm doing now is to do with climate change, but how it impacts the world and importantly, marginalized communities, and really impacts people who are at the worst end of it, who don't actually contribute to it anyway. So I guess I've got this like real eye-opening perspective over the last 3 years of both individual actions, but like global actions. And so I think I've just been like really immersed in all of these kind of conversations. Yeah, for the past like three and a bit years.
Wow, that's so cool. And like when you were growing up, did you have any idea about climate change? And were you already living like quite an ethical lifestyle growing up in your family? Or did it just come from a spark at university?
Yeah, I mean, I think I loved the outdoors. Like I feel any environmentalist probably begins with, oh, I loved going hiking or something. But you know, there's probably some David Attenborough quote about like needing to know about nature to love it. But I think that really was true. But I don't, my parents might cringe, but you know, I don't think we lived a particularly ethical lifestyle. I mean, we were very clued up about fair trade. That was a big thing, you know, like trying to make sure we were doing fair trade. And my grandparents were really into gardening, and so that kind of trickled down. But I wouldn't say we lived a particularly ethical lifestyle. I think we were probably good but not great, but probably just good by accident. You know, we didn't really make a lot of effort. But I guess one of the important things to now say is that even though I'm trying really hard to live an ethical lifestyle, I am still way much more of a problem than like many people across the world, just because like we all live in the UK, or you might live in America or wherever, and like these are big countries with big emissions. So without even leaving my house, like I'm emitting more than many, like 99% probably of the world. So I guess in relation to other people in Glasgow or Scotland or the UK, like probably yeah, I'm a bit more sustainable, but actually globally not really. But I definitely think I've grown up getting more of an awareness, and bringing my family along with me, which has been quite fun.
That's, did they like put up a fight or were they good with it?
I mean, some stuff's funny, you know. I think I definitely went through a bit of a phase as being an activist. It was like, you're the problem, like that's just the little thing you've got, like this is the reason why David Attenborough had to do Blue Planet. I think, you know, it used to be like, I don't know if you remember that TV program Kim and Aggie, where they would go into people's houses and it'd be dirty and they'd just be like exposing them, be like, look how filthy your house is. People used to be like, Laura, when you come into my house I'm like hiding the plastic, which obviously is not a good thing to be doing with your friends. But I think they've been, I think we've enjoyed the challenge as a family. But I think the biggest thing is, as a, and you'll know this, like as a younger person, you haven't set up a rhythm of life. So my grandparents have lived in the house they've lived in for over 50 years. So they've got a routine. My parents have lived in the house that I'm in just now for 25 years. Like they have their routines, they have their set ways of doing things. And so having to shake that up, it's harder for them. Rather than, you know, when I started this journey, I was like 21 and just like, oh, well, whatever. If I need to change my shopping, I can change my shopping. If I need to get the bus everywhere, I can get the bus everywhere. Like you guys will know this probably because you've moved around a bit in your, you know, in your younger years, and you can kind of disrupt your own way of thinking a bit more.
Yeah, it's exactly. A nice piece to think about it.
I was gonna ask, do your friends still get scared of you when you go over?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, I think part of it, it's a bit of a joke, but I kind of enjoy the fact that it's stuck in people's minds, because you know, in the same way that maybe some people, I am the person that they think of when they hear plastic or climate change. You know, I've got friends who are great fitness advocates or are great mental health advocates or are great sustainable fashion advocates. And so when I think of stuff, I think of them. And actually it's great because it's a reminder, because I'm thinking like, what would they say if they saw me in this situation, or like, how would they encourage me? And so I think sometimes you need that person in your life to be encouraging and bringing you along, kind of for the journey, which I think has been quite nice. And now definitely I remember I sort of went on this radical like journey of becoming an activist really quickly. And then I moved to Edinburgh to do my master's, and I moved in with this girl who was like a friend of a friend. And my mum was a bit like, just don't be too full on, because you don't really know her yet.
Don't scare her just yet.
Yeah. And actually it was quite nice because, you know, we both moved into this flat. And so, you know, if you went to pee, you would see her toothbrush, plastic, mine bamboo. But it's not like I came in and said, by the way, this toothbrush I bought is way better. But, and so, you know, we would put our stuff away in the kitchen cupboards, and I'd have all these like wax wraps, and she would have like, you know, cling film. But actually slowly, like I remember the day a bamboo toothbrush appeared in her spot, and I was like, it's happened. Like, I didn't have to. But actually I think, you know, having that little like encouragement from friends is actually super helpful.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And especially I think sometimes it can feel almost daunting to start on the journey itself. Yeah. So having someone as a reference point is always good.
Mm-hmm. I think it's funny as well when you see like you went through that phase of activism when you were just shouting at people.
Because I think we've all done that.
I've went through that.
Because when you said, I have friends who get scared of me, and I was like, oh, Amy.
I'm that gal, but I think I'm getting better. But I think it's also because you're almost angry at yourself. You're thinking, I need to be better. So you're thinking constantly about all the plastic you're buying and beating yourself up about it. So you automatically just exude that. Yeah. Anger at the plastic and I'm glad to see that you get through the phase, and I won't always be like that.
So we've talked about, so a lot of people are aware how, well, I'm guessing not a lot of people are aware of how bad climate change actually is and how humans are accelerating it. So can you give us an idea of where we are currently and how bad the situation is?
Absolutely. I mean, you could do a whole PhD on this, let alone podcast episode. Yeah. But I think the important thing to remember is that the climate has always changed and weather has changed. You know, before recording, we were talking about how sunny it is now and it's nice and spring is here. You know, weather changing is totally natural and the climate changing is totally natural. And if you look back thousands of years, if not longer, you will see patterns of the climate changing, and we know that it happens at different rates, and we know that it happens for different reasons, and we know that it happens for natural reasons, and we know that it happens for anthropogenic. And anthropogenic is this term to do with people, basically that's our impact on the planet. And so I think there's really interesting, you get these geological epochs, which are basically time scales over, you know, thousands if not longer of years, and they describe the time that we're in and the times that we've been in. So there's ones like the Holocene, which is the one that we're in just now, but actually right now people are describing what we are in right now as the Anthropocene, because humans are having such a big impact on the planet, we almost need to like bookend it and go, this is a whole new geological epoch. Yeah. Because the face of the earth, and I guess you could include the atmosphere, are being changed. But I guess to think in numbers, or I guess to give you some perspective of how we talk about climate change, there's this term thrown around and it is degrees of warming since pre-industrial time. So that is a marker after the Industrial Revolution, and we sort of take degrees of warming since that point and relate it to where we are. So we are currently sitting globally at about 1.3 degrees warmer as an average globally since pre-industrial times. And 1.3 when you're sitting in Scotland is like, oh great, give me more of that. But actually globally, a shift of even a point of a degree can cause mass, you know, ice melts, or it can cause droughts, or it can cause flooding. It can have huge impacts, and we're currently sitting about 1.3. and there's a big scientific group called the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they are the ones who really gave out the most robust climate science. And they produced this report, which is referred to all the time. And they said in it that 1.5 degrees of warming would be really bad, and 2 degrees would be disastrous. But one of the things that we do know is that we're at 1.3 already, and actually 1.3 is already really bad for communities. You know, we've got, I mean, I was trying to think, knowing I was coming onto this podcast, like what examples of climate change could I give? And it's almost just like, which ones do you want to pick? You know, there's so many, because there's the classic examples of things like the Australian forest fires that we know swept across the world. Feels like not that long ago, but I think that's because lockdowns kind of warped our perception of time. But we also have things like, you know, we've just seen the massive almost ice age that happened in Texas, completely unnatural in the sense that that doesn't normally happen, and that is a consequence of a changing climate, and a changing climate that's happening quicker than ever would naturally because we are intervening with it. And so I think it's really important to just realize that yes, climate changing is normal, but at the rate of which it's going so rapidly, it's going so quickly, and the most important point is it's going too quick for us to manage, both humans where we live and biospheres, animals, like everything. Nobody can keep up with it quick enough.
So when you say the 1.3 degrees, is that purely because of human intervention? Because you said the climate changes, but would it have increased naturally, or would it have stayed stable?
I guess it's one of those questions that you don't know what would happen if we weren't here. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that when we look at historic climate change, it's never happened this quickly.
Okay.
And for example, you know, you have examples of the climate changing globally way long ago, when massive explosions of volcanoes basically blacked out the sun and then we entered ice ages, right? So that's like this, the kind of impact we're having. It's happening so quick, it's almost. And so I think it's important to realize that the actions we are having are just a metric. So we talk about it mostly in terms of carbon emissions, this CO2 equivalence, but really any greenhouse gas is what they're called. These are the things that are causing global warming, which is causing climate change. So these are the kind of like two terms that we use, but we just know that it's happening quicker than it's ever happened before. And we know that it's because of humans, because when we look at the carbon being emitted, we can trace it back to things that humans are doing.
Yeah. I think it's terrifying. And it's I think when you're not a scientist or a climate scientist and you've seen the news global warming, but then you see Texas, for instance, going into some sort of ice age, it's hard to understand that it's not, global warming isn't just making everything hotter, it's kind of disrupting all normal weather patterns, which could mean you end up colder or with more rain. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. When we talk about climate change, it's difficult. I mean, we're going to get onto the conversation about food, which is similar in the same way that what is the case for one place around the world, take Glasgow, for instance, is not going to be the same as somewhere else on the planet. You know, every location is different. We have different formations around us. We have mountain ranges between us. We have oceans in the way. And so the impacts seen in one place will be different. But I guess, you know, kind of from my geography background, one of the things you think about is, so we've got a world that is warming. We know that. You know, everywhere is warming globally by this 1.3 degrees and it's going up. And that will have different impacts in different places. So in places that have ice, that will be melting. But then in places with not ice, but maybe sort of scarce water, that is then going to be disappearing and you're going to be having drought. So in one place, you're having loads of water suddenly appearing, and another, you're having water disappearing. And when you think about the global water cycle, that water has to go somewhere. So that ends up flooding, I don't know, part of, you know, we've got the Midlands in England flooding all the time now. And so you've kind of got different impacts for different places. And so you need to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt, because I think a lot of people do get confused when we talk about global warming, because you think, well, we're not getting warmer, we're getting colder, or we're having extreme cold events. In the same way that some places are having droughts and some places are having flooding. And so I guess one of the big things we're trying to make people see is that climate change is different. So I think in the UK, we're sort of expecting to have milder weather, but in certain places wetter. And like, I'm from Glasgow, so please no more rain. That would be absolutely awful. And so it's putting pressures on systems that are already. And so I guess it's a lot of the time it's thinking about what issues do you already have? Because they're probably just going to get worse. So, you know, the Midlands or the Lowlands of England are probably going to get more flooding and they already can't cope. And then you could take a different area. You know, there's large parts of sub-Saharan Africa that have problems with droughts. That is going to get worse. And so it's kind of exacerbating pre-existing problems and making just everything a lot worse.
Yeah. And I think as well, like, the fact that it's happening as we speak, it's not some distant disaster movie that might happen to our grandkids, it's happening already. Just, have you heard that analogy or metaphor about the frog, where you put the frog in boiling, so if you put a frog in boiling water, it jumps out, but if you put a frog in gradual heated water, it'll die because it just acclimatizes to it. But that's what's happening to us, basically, we're just getting used to it.
Yeah, and I think one of the big things is, you know, people might hear the phrases a couple of years ago, it's 11 years to sort it out, 10 years to sort it out, 9 years to sort it out, and, you know, we've got X number of years to be net zero or carbon neutral or whatever term you want to use. And I think part of the problem with using this terminology is the fact that it takes away from the experience of people right now who are facing climate change right now. And so, you know, it's not, we don't really have 9 years, because many people don't. You know, there are, it's hard to quantify how many climate refugees, which is a new term that has had to be developed because people are having to move. It's hard to even quantify how many people are having to move or are being displaced. And so to turn around to them and say, oh yeah, we've got 9 years to sort out climate change, it's like, well, we don't, because that person has already had to move. So they didn't have 9 years, they didn't even have 9 minutes. And so, you know, I think that the urgency needs to be urgent and not just, oh, it's really urgent, we've got a decade, it's urgent, we need to sort it now.
Yeah, definitely.
So when we're speaking about human contribution to climate change. What is, does that consist mainly of the industry and like agriculture, or are there other factors influencing this as well?
Yeah, there's quite a few, and I guess part of it is naturally the world sucks in carbon, so it sequesters carbon and it emits carbon. Like, that's natural. You've got trees, you've got soil, you've got oceans, but the activities and inactivity, I guess, that humans do will produce different carbon emissions or sequester, you know, it'll also take it in. So you've got everything from, you know, transport, the way we move around the world, energy, so the way that we power our homes or the way that, you know, industries are run. Food and agriculture is a huge part of that as well. How we produce, where we produce, I mean, how we transport that again. And then you've got smaller things, you know, you've got things like fashion in there, you know, you've got specific industries that you would maybe want to put a bit more emphasis on, you've got construction. And so really any activity you do as a human will have some sort of carbon attached to it, whether, you know, even if you were to just wake up in your house, do nothing all day, read a book and then go to bed, you've still probably used some energy to just function. But there are definitely more, and there are other industries within those who take up more of the carbon chunk than others.
Mm-hmm. I actually seen on Facebook the other day, it was like a post saying, how bad is your Netflix binging habit really bad for the environment? I was like, no, don't take that away. But it's true. Yeah, it's basically, it doesn't have to be that you're flying around the world every day to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think when you look at your personal carbon footprint, there's definitely different ways you can spend it, and you can spend it in bigger chunks than the other. But I remember reading that and someone was talking, I was on a Zoom call the other day and it was with an environmental group, and somebody put on saying, we should all turn off our videos because it saves 96% of the carbon emissions, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, there's honestly carbon attached to everything nowadays. And sometimes it gets ridiculous and you think, I'm not sitting on a Zoom call with my, like, with everyone's camera off. And you know that. But actually, it is important to realize that even data storage for your phone somewhere in a big tech thing in Silicon Valley will be using up carbon, and we have to kind of realize that.
Yeah. Oh. So obviously we wanted to discuss veganism, how that can help for the planet, but do you want to tell us about why meat agriculture is so bad for the planet?
Yeah, I think again we probably just need to first of all sort of angle this conversation with the fact that when we speak about any food or any diet, it's going to be different around the world. So there is no like one size fits all when it comes to the best practice for the way that we eat as individuals or countries, but we can speak in general terms. And then I guess I can speak, you know, I'm from Glasgow, I've lived in Scotland all my life, so I can kind of speak to that experience as well and some of the things that we could do. But globally there's a few different reasons why meat and meat products are slightly worse for the environment, and that is a few different things. The first thing is that meat takes up land, so we need land to graze cattle, and it is the biggest reason for deforestation globally is to make area for cattle. And so globally we are deforesting our land to make room for animals, and on top of that, when you think about it, you have the land that it takes for an animal to be grown on, plus you then need to make the food that they eat. So there's these estimations, and you need to take a pinch of salt with all of these, but these are pretty kind of industry standard for talking about this, that if everyone in the world was to eat plant-based, we would actually need 75% less animal, like agriculture, farmland globally. So when you think about running out of land, we think, well, actually, we would just need less land, because instead of growing a sheep or a cow or a something, plus all of the land to grow its food, you're just having to grow that original food. And so the fact that we are needing more land, and particularly more land in really precious areas like the Amazon, which is the big place that people talk about, it is meaning what would have been there if we hadn't grown that meat. And the answer is big, beautiful trees that suck out lots of carbon, but instead we are ripping them up, or sometimes deforesting by doing forest fires, which then of course is emitting carbon, which is causing climate change. And so the first thing is just to do with like land use, and it's actually just, are there better uses for that land? Is the land currently doing something better for the climate? And when we come in and take away that land, how are we doing it? And is it in a way that is contributing to climate change? And then also it's just having to think about the fact that animals themselves emit greenhouse gases. So, you know, we talk about this methane thing, and that is because there are different types of animals, particularly cattle and sheep, that just emit lots of methane. And that in itself is a greenhouse gas, and we need to take that into consideration. So these are the kind of two biggest players when we talk about climate change. It's the fact that we are removing land around the world, beautiful land that would otherwise be sucking out all that carbon for us and putting it deep into the ground. We're then ripping it up, exposing the soil. And really, whenever you see soil, it's emitting carbon. We need to like capture it and like put something over it, anything. Or we're burning it, you know, we're literally burning carbon and emitting that. And then we're putting on something that isn't really that sustainable.
I had no idea that. So I knew deforestation was a thing, and I thought it was just to get the wood from the trees, but I never thought about what they did with the land afterwards. Well, that makes so much more sense.
Yeah. I mean, I was speaking to one of my colleagues who works in Brazil, and he was kind of speaking about the fact that this is one of the huge issues, that actually it is just so profitable to be doing animal agriculture. And most of this is for exports, you know, most of this is for selling around the world. So that's us. We have to put up our hands and say, like, that's our demand that we're putting on other countries. Mm-hmm. And actually realizing that the big beautiful forests that are there, they're not economically viable, they're not doing anything. You do have schemes like the United Nations RED scheme, mm-hmm. which is basically other countries paying for them to keep it the way it is to try and make it profitable. But ultimately, you've got a big beautiful piece of land that doesn't make you any money. Or you could just go and set it on fire, put some cattle on it, and then boom, you've got a business. And so I think it is a really nuanced conversation, but it's important to kind of know that. And also, I didn't even know that the biggest cause of deforestation was animals. I thought it was something mm-hmm. else. I don't know what I thought it was, but I didn't.
Paper, maybe?
Yeah, I thought it was paper as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So see, if you were to compare huge deforestation for land, for cattle, and compare it to like a local farmer up north Scotland, is there better farming techniques, and is that a more sustainable way to eat meat?
Yeah, I think this is a really big question. And so I did my master's with the Edinburgh University, but it was joint with SRUC, which is Scotland's Rural College. And they do a lot of work with agriculture and with farmers. And one of the things, if you've ever been, or a listener's ever been, like up the northwest coast of Scotland, you're not growing anything there. It is rocky, it is outcroppy, it's not flat, it is not, you know, it's not arable land that you can grow other types of crops on it. But sheep, they're hardy. They will last and last, and you can fling them out and a couple of times a year take them in and bring them back. And so part of the question is, so the land in the Amazon, for example, can do so much better for the climate, being left as it is, being pristine and not being deforested or burned to turn into cattle farming. But there's many regions around the world that wouldn't be able to do any of that and can't suck out loads of carbon. And actually putting grazing livestock on them, the land itself is not being degraded. So we're not doing anything bad with that there. So I guess there's a couple of kind of things to think about. You know, it's definitely not black and white. So I guess when you talk about agricultural practice in the UK, it's better because we're not removing forests, like we're not removing part of the Amazon to do that. But there are still many, many ways that we can encourage farmers here to be more sustainable. There are many different farming practices that we can put in place. And I think it's important that we do that, because one of the things that happens with this conversation is you get people going, but we're so much better in the UK. Mm-hmm. And then the conversation mm-hmm. sort of stops. And you think, okay, that might be the case, but there's always room for improvement and there's always ways to do it. And so, you know, absolutely, if you're talking about a beef burger and you're saying a beef burger that deforested the Amazon, that's come all that way, you know, it's mm-hmm. been traveled all that way over, versus a beef burger that's been grown in Scotland somewhere, yes, it will be more sustainable. Like, that just is the case. But that doesn't mean that Scotland burger's off the hook. And it doesn't mean there might not maybe be an even better alternative for that.
Wow.
So I guess first and big question on veganism is, should we all be vegans? Should we all consider switching to that? And by all, I guess it's important to note both like the developed countries like the UK and America and stuff, but also if we're talking about developing countries, how would that work for them as well?
Absolutely. And this is where there is no yes or no answer. And I think if anyone was to give you a yes or no answer, they would be biased and they'd be on one side. Mm-hmm. And I think many people, in the same way that I used to be a like radical environmentalist telling people that they're, I think people have also been on that journey saying everyone needs to be vegan or everyone doesn't need to be vegan. And I think we need to find a middle ground and offer up people, because I think there's a huge part of this that is about accessibility. So what's in your price range? What is literally what's grown around you? What's local? What's seasonal? And how do we avoid doing anything that creates monocrops? Because what we don't want to do is say to the world, right, we're just going to cover the world all in big, massive farms of all the same things. And then we start to introduce other problems. But actually, I think personally, we all just need to be more deliberate and conscious with our food choices. And I think part of that is being more plant-based. So that's my like watered down, really conservative answer to that question. But I think it's because you really you cannot give a yes or no. And I think, I mean, I could unpack all of those things, but I think we probably will discuss them all like individually. But you know, I think there's just too many what's the word?
Like variables.
Yeah, too many variables to just give a yes or no answer to this. But I do think we can all play a part with being more conscious with our food choices.
Yeah, I appreciate that answer, because usually it is the people being like, you should definitely be vegan, you should cut everything out of your diet, and it's daunting. It's really scary for someone to just be like, change your entire lifestyle, you're killing the planet, and rather just be like, do, like, you need to take baby steps to get there. And it's about accessibility, like you said. So yeah,
and I think as well, like, we've already seen in a way Eco Life getting like a popular, or brands thinking it's something cool
mainstream
to make, to make money from. So can it get to the point where if everyone decided we'll be vegan, then it becomes unsustainable because everyone's now doing it and punk companies still want to make money?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we need to look at the roots of where veganism came from, because every term has been coined at some point, but the idea of a plant-based diet is not a new one. And you have centuries, if not millennia, of particularly indigenous groups living in harmony with the world, many of whom will live largely plant-based diets, if not, you know, just almost fully. And I think it's important to really look back and say, well, that's what we're aiming for. We're aiming to live in harmony with the world. Mm-hmm. Obviously, none of the conversation we're having today is about the sort of ethics or like welfare, because that's a whole other conversation which can easily be answered in a yes or no. But if we're talking about sustainability, actually, it's about like, what do we want to achieve from a vegan diet? Because if you think everyone should be vegan for sustainability reasons, like, that needs to be opened up and unpacked way, way more, because there's definitely not this yes or no. But I think it's so important to remember those roots, and actually let's not allow monopolies within the vegan industry or the greenwashing industry, because that is something that is definitely rife and definitely something that's happening. And we definitely need to tread the line with, just because it's vegan doesn't mean it's sustainable.
Yeah.
Those words are not interchangeable. And a lot of the time we have to fight that. We have to fight that really hard, because I think vegan's been taken as a word that's sustainable, and it's just not. And that's also hard, because you feel like, I'm just trying to do the right thing. Yeah. And then you sort of unpack it.
But you see it, like, I think I try and read about climate and understand sustainability somewhat, but even myself, I find getting trapped with these things. I'll go into a shop and look at, say, it's two products that are the same thing, but one says organic or vegan, and your mind just goes to it because you're like, good, that is that means good. But it doesn't. It's just often the brand knows how to trick you.
Yeah, I mean, this example I'm going to give is not about a vegan one, but it's one that I remember having, and I think I stood in the shopping aisle for about 5 minutes just staring, because it was when I started this journey with plastic. So it was a bit before I really started to even think about food.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the example I'm giving is something that's not even sustainable anyway, but I was wanting to buy some bananas, right? So I'm sitting looking at the bananas, and there on the left was a bunch of bananas, like loads of bananas, not in plastic, not fair trade. And then to the right, there was bananas, fair trade, in plastic. And I was just like, what is the better option? Which one do I go for? And then I started just going, are bananas even sustainable? Maybe I just shouldn't have anything. And I thought, I can't, if I went around every item, I would come back with nothing but, I don't know, a turnip and a few potatoes. Like, that's not a healthy diet. And so part of it is the fact that the responsibility is placed on us as an individual, as a consumer, to make the right choice. But then we do have to wade through this greenwashing or ethical washing to be like, what does that mean? Like, what does organic mean? I'm actually, what are all of these things? Because often when you start to look into the labels, you realize that stuff has such low standards that they have to meet to get some of these accreditation, or you have terms like natural. Well, fossil fuels are technically natural, but I wouldn't be eating them. But, you know, so actually, how do we talk about some of that? And I remember one of the biggest things I had was realizing that when I started to go down this route of wanting to be more plant-based, suddenly realizing that actually by swapping out milk or butter, you're suddenly putting in things like almonds and soy and palm oil. And I was like, well, all of these things are things I also think are unsustainable. So which really is it? And actually, when you Google this stuff, you just get bias on either side. Mm-hmm. So if you Google, is dairy milk good for the environment or is soy milk good for the environment, you're going to just get 50-50 articles from people on either side. And then it's kind of up to us to be like, well, what's the middle ground and what do I think's right?
Yeah. And I think as well, like, understanding that nothing is 100% sustainable. And I've thought it myself, like, I switched to oat milk and actually just, it was easy for me because I actually prefer it. I don't really like dairy. But then I'm thinking to myself, am I doing good because it's in a plastic carton? And it's trying to weigh up those things, isn't it?
Yeah, that the milk dilemma is one that I've had so many times in my life. Because when I started my journey to being sustainable, I just ate what I would say is a normal, as in there was nothing I didn't eat. I ate kind of everything. I ate meat a few times a week, you know, had dairy probably every day. And ate stuff from all around the world. I wasn't really concerned about packaging and I wasn't really concerned about local, so probably the worst in the world, but anyway. And so one of the things that I started to do was think about milk, and there was a local dairy, like local to where I lived, doing local deliveries on an electric vehicle in glass, and I thought, that's amazing. But then I started to look into the impact, and then I thought, right, well, there are better options out there, but all of them come in Tetra Pak, which, even though it's recyclable, I don't believe in recycling. That's a whole other podcast episode you could do, because recycling is an absolute myth and it's rubbish. But anyway, so I was like, what do I go for? Do I go for something that definitely has packaging and it's going to be hard to recycle, if not impossible? Or do I go for something that's local and, you know, it's dairy and it's glass? And I was like, I just gave up on milk for about 6 months. And I was like, this is not the answer, because it was like the bananas. I was just going to give up. And actually now, me and my family, we get... Finally, these delivery companies have started to do oat milk in glass bottles. So that is a solution for us, because I'm the same, love oat milk. I think it's great. Mm. And I can now get it delivered locally in a glass bottle with zero waste. Perfect. But actually, that took 3 years for that to happen. And that was 3 years of me either drinking milk and then feeling really guilty about it, or drinking oat milk and packaging and feeling guilty. And I thought, why am I feeling guilty just trying to have a cup of tea? Like, this is ridiculous. And like, that shouldn't be anything anyone is feeling.
So how do you seen on your I was just gonna say about the oat milk, I seen your Instagram post.
Yes, same.
Finally, and it went on to do it.
And doesn't deliver to flats.
Yeah.
Well,
just like, oh,
I'll be outside.
Are you both in Glasgow?
Yeah.
Right. Because hold on a minute. I got an Instagram. Here you go, you can spread this around. So I got an Instagram from someone who reached out saying, hi, so excited about all of this. They're another company that deliver oat milk. And I was a bit like, like, I've kind of already posted about it. And then she said, we deliver to flats. And I was like, what? Yes. Everyone says that. So they're called, free shout out, but they're called, well, you can take it out of your, but they're called the Glasgow Dairy Company. And they're also called the Dundee Dairy Company, because they do Glasgow and Dundee. Ooh, so it's like, so Glasgow Dairy.
Amy, we're going to get our oat milk.
So I thought that was amazing, because I thought that was the big thing. It was like, after 3 years of waiting, there we finally had oat milk and glass. But then there was everyone going, oh, but we can't get it because we live in a flat. And I thought, are you joking? But now we have hope. But actually, these solutions are becoming so much more widely available. And this is what we need as consumers, to actually then invest our money into these companies to really show support.
Yeah.
So that they're the ones that flourish and not the ones that find the loopholes and everything.
Exactly. And, you know, I think part of it is also like pushing. So to all of the oat milk, here's my message to them, to all of the oat milk companies that do still have packaging, I want to buy you, but you're making it hard for me to buy you. So you need to also take the steps to like help your consumer, because mm-hmm. that is another thing, a pet peeve of mine, of sort of vegan stuff. Not only do they use these words to like encourage people being sustainable, they also are like, oh, but we're vegan. And I'm like, that doesn't mean you cannot do mm-hmm. stuff with packaging or not be sustainable in other ways. Like, you can still take more steps, like come with us on a journey. It's not enough for you to just be plant-based. Let's keep moving and growing, because in, you know, the dairy companies were changing to glass, and I was like, keep up, like you are missing customers because of this. So I'm glad to see that is kind of like on the move, definitely.
Yeah, because it's benefiting companies as well if they're going to keep up with demand.
I was going to ask, so do you think all of, because brands are listening to consumers now, and is that because veganism has increased over the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, any trend, there are going to be businesses that are jumping on it, whether that's positive or negative. You know, I think there was a stats out about Veganuary, which is a sort of a way of estimating the interest in veganism, particularly here in the UK. You know, in 2014, they had a few thousand people sign up. And in 2019, they had over 250,000. And so you can see that the industry of veganism is growing rapidly, and companies are jumping on the back of that. In a good way, hopefully. You know, I mean, they obviously want to make money, but I think it's also important to see that they are shifting, and that actually by individuals deciding to make lifestyle changes, we are seeing these shifts. And I think that's also an important message to send backwards to activists and to people that have been doing it. You know, there's people who have been vegan not just for 3 or 4 years, but for 13 or 15 or even longer, you know. And I think it's important to send a message to them, say like, thank you, because you stuck with it, other people are now with you, and we now have this change. And that is the really important part.
I actually have a friend's mum who has been vegetarian her whole life, and she says, when I go to a restaurant now, it's too much choice, I don't know what to choose, because I'm used to just getting like the cheese sandwich, because that was all that was on to offer. But yeah, now the fact that it's, I wouldn't be shocked when someone told me they're a vegan. Maybe I would have been when I was a child. In fact, I probably wouldn't even know what it was back then.
But now it's just so much easier to be vegan, I think. Like, it's one of those things which I guess brings us to the next question, is we talked about greenwashing and brands jumping on the bandwagon. I guess as a consumer, how do you do what's right? Like, what did you do with the bananas?
You know, I think I actually left the shop not buying bananas, because I was just like, I can't deal with this. But yeah, I think partly it's just asking yourself the question of like, is this better? Like, just try and think about it without their marketing or without their branding, and just think, first of all, do you need the thing? You know, when it comes to food, we know that we waste food and that we don't eat, you know, we don't use up what we have. And so it's important to just be like, first of all, do I need this product? Second of all, does the company ethos line up with it, or is this just another thing? And you know, I think partly for me, if people are wanting to go down a vegan route with their diet purely for sustainability reasons, I'd maybe ask them to branch out a bit and say, maybe don't think just this single like plant-based, like have that as your thing. Maybe broaden it out a bit and think about like what's local to you, what's vegan and what's local to you, and what are some of the like swaps and alternatives that you can make around what it is. Because ultimately, if you're to swap out a diet, but then everything you put in is bad for the environment in another way, so maybe it's only stuff from other places, you know, far-flung countries around the world, maybe we need to think about that a bit more. Or maybe it's stuff that comes in excessive packaging, or maybe it's another thing, you know, we kind of need to think about it all together. But ultimately, I think we can say that switching out bits and bobs throughout the week is really good. Like, that's a really great place to start, and that's where I would always encourage people to go from.
I seen you posted on your Instagram a while ago about the fact that you obviously try and not use as much plastic, and you look for packaging issues. But when you go into shop and see things that are reduced and going to be binned, then you kind of allow yourself to buy it. And yeah, if you're in the shop and you see meat that's about to be thrown out, is that the same thing? Like, you can almost it's more sustainable to take it that day.
Yeah, so one of the big things to think about is when it comes to food waste is organic. And when it starts to break down, one of the greenhouse gases that it emits is methane. And methane is a greenhouse gas that is worse than carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is often what comes out of fossil fuels. So that's what we talk about when we talk about transport or when we talk about energy and industry. But actually food waste and food products have a large carbon footprint as well, especially when they're thrown away in the wrong ways. So the right way is through composting, or, you know, in your garden or with council collections. So when food goes to the wrong place, that's when we start to get considerable greenhouse gas emissions, and that's when it becomes a problem. So interestingly, when you have a supermarket that has food packaged in plastic, so whether it's vegetables, meat, you know, ready meals, anything, when that goes out of date, and that's just the date that's on the packaging, like legally supermarkets have to throw that away.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't sit, I mean, I was naive and thought they might, they don't sit and open it all up and compost all the food bits and wash out the recycling and put it in the, they just chuck it all into landfill. That's just what happens to it. So part of the problem is that's just a waste. There's been loads of emissions that have gone into creating all of that and the transport and getting it there and making the packaging and everything. And then it's just thrown away. But worse is the fact that it's thrown away trapped inside this packaging. So it's not going to naturally decompose and create lovely compost and help be circular to grow more food. It's just going to sit in a landfill rotting inside of a plastic bag or a plastic tub. So one of the things I allow myself when I'm in a supermarket is when I see things that are reduced, I want to buy them, because I know, especially, I did this around Christmas time, it's the best time to go actually, because you get loads of reduced, but that's just because I'm a cheapskate. But actually, especially if you go late at night, you know, it's like you're standing there going, if I don't pick this up, nobody will. And particularly when the shelves are stacked, you're like, definitely nobody will, because there's too much food here. And there's only been a tiny amount of supermarkets offering that food up, like to farms who might be able to give it to livestock. You know, it basically all just goes into landfill. There's only a small number of those farm initiatives or maybe like community fridges, but basically we're talking about the vast majority of it going there. So that's a long way to say that I do offer that as a bit of an exception, because I know that by me taking it home and eating the contents and disposing of the packaging correctly, that's a better final destination for all of that stuff than it would be in landfill. The only caveat is it's a bit confusing, because one thing I'm actually not sure of, because I've never been able to get a clear answer, is when I buy that, does the supermarket count that as a purchased item that was reduced, or do they still count that in the stock and still overbuy? Because what we don't want to encourage supermarkets to do is to continue buying too much food and then letting it go out of date. And I've never been able to get a straight answer as to whether buying that helps with that problem. But I guess with knowing that, I still think it's better to give that food a nice final destination in my kitchen rather than in a landfill.
That's a very nice way to look at it, and yeah, just using what you need.
I think in the last few years as well, I know a lot of places, so I went to uni in London, and I know this happened with the prep cafes there, where they used to give their food away to like food banks.
Yeah.
I think someone got food poisoning and tried to sue them. That's and then the story they completely everywhere. I know, right? So it's like an urban myth at this point, but they stopped giving their food away to food banks, or like just giving their food away. So I always think if that's the reason why like grocery stores do the same thing, because it's just food waste at that point. They're not making any money throwing in a landfill, so why are they not donating it to places?
I know. We also, I mean, we go a step further in the UK, in this country, because we have laws that mean we also lock up our bins to make sure that people don't take it. Because there's a really interesting guy that I follow on Instagram.
Mm.
I think he's called the Urban Harvester. So he was born in England, but he now lives, I think, in Denmark. I probably got that wrong, but somewhere in Europe where they don't have the same laws. And he goes dumpster diving or sort of bin raiding. And he has these immense hauls that are just ridiculous. But part of the thing is, I'm like, at least he's getting it. At least he's getting stuff right. But yeah, in the UK, we have laws that mean it gets locked up. Or I've had sort of private conversations with people who work in supermarkets who say that they actually end up spoiling, like they deliberately spoil the food so that people don't go in and get it because it wouldn't be safe to do. And you think that is bonkers, that that is a law, because there are people who would take that food because, I mean, I don't want to get sued by saying this, but like best before dates and sell by dates, like, are you joking? I mean, we've all eaten something that's a bit past it and it's fine.
100%. Yeah. I get reduced meat and freeze it and it's fine because I froze it.
Absolutely. And I think that by doing this, it doesn't offer us any opportunity. And part of it is also to think about it from an ethical point of view. You think any meat that goes out of date, you're like, that's a life that has just, like, what was the point in that whole animal's existence if it didn't even get consumed and it didn't actually bring any benefit? And like, I also think that, you know, I have friends that are farmers of cattle and you think they do genuinely, like, doesn't matter your opinion of it, but they care for those animals. They would hate to think that they'll, you know, it didn't even make it onto someone's plate and so all of that work was for nothing.
I don't agree, but I almost understand why supermarkets wouldn't hand out the food to someone in case they were sued or whatever. But with the dumpster stuff, it's like at that point you've got no responsibility. Just you're just being evil now. You're genuinely not wanting people to eat.
I think it's that anti-homelessness laws and all that. Like yesterday, my friend and I were sitting on a bench, and she was like, "It's really small, isn't it?" I was like, "So it's to stop people from sleeping on it at night." And she's like, why would people do such a thing? And I think that locking thing is probably on that same
line. And it's just it's part of this thing, isn't it, that it's probably just because we live in this capitalist world that's like we don't want to encourage anyone getting anything for free because we want to. And you just think it is ridiculous that we are just making the world full of stuff that we can't even sell. We can't even sell enough of it. But also just shows that the margins, these supermarkets, if they can just throw all of that away with absolutely no regard, you think this is ridiculous.
Yeah. So do you think because we live in such a capitalist world and everything's based off of making money, can we truly go fully sustainable at any point?
With capitalism.
With capitalism in mind.
I mean,
the aim of capitalism is so you keep buying stuff.
Yeah, I think part of it is, you know, people throw around the phrase, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism. And I just think we just need to slow down. It's not very, you know, it's not very scientific and it's not an economic theory, but that's what we need to do. We just need to slow down. And I think under that, you have many different terms. You've got, we need to become more circular. We need to have a circular economy. We need to keep things moving in a loop. You know, we can't, right now we're doing this. Capitalist is one world, but linear. So we just take things, we make them into something, and then we dispose of it straight away. And that doesn't align with sustainability because it's not living in harmony. It's not caring for the planet. It's not thinking about, okay, actually, at the rate we're pulling stuff out the ground, whether it's trees or fossil fuels or food, can we replenish that for next year? Or is that degrading the land too much so that next year it's not actually, we're going to have to pump it full of fertilizer or whatever. And so I think right now we cannot live in the system that we're in, but that takes breaking it out of it. And maybe lockdown has given us a bit of a taste of what that might be like, because at the beginning I was speaking about the whole 1.3, 1.5, 2 degrees of warming, warming. And we know that to be on track, to not go over 1.5 degrees of warming globally, the whole world needs to reduce carbon emissions by about 7% every year. Mm-hmm. That's this number. And in 2020, the world did that. I mean, we did it because of a pandemic, but we did it. But actually, it proves the drastic change we need. Now, the majority of that 7% reduction was made up of transport because, you know, most flights went down to about, you know, less than 30%, if not much further down in terms of capacity. We had people, you know, I'm thinking about the cars that we have sitting in the drive, like we've hardly used our cars. People have hardly been, you know, public transport's been reduced. And so we do know that a world to be sustainable is possible. We obviously just need to find a way that's not locking everyone in their homes for a year. But I think it is important to say that we can still consume, and I'm not against all consumption. It's just this idea that we need to be sustainable. We need to be more circular. We need to, you know, not be wasting food, not be growing on land that could otherwise be doing something else, something better. I think it's kind of taking all of that into consideration. And it's just about saying that the system we're in right now is not
doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I read a book called The Climate Majority. I don't know if you read that. But it was really good because it was the author was explaining how people who are interested in climate change are already interested in things like ethics and human rights. But the only way that we're going to solve the system is by flipping it to basically people who make money from capitalism and the big companies and say, this is how it's going to impact you, and making ways to change it that suits them as well, because otherwise it's not going to. Do you think there's a way to change in general everything but the food industry that suits these companies and suits the planet?
Oh, I think this is a difficult one, because ultimately if you have a business, you're out there to make money, and there's not many businesses around the world that will say, no, we're happy just making enough profit to pay our staff and that's fine. Like, pretty much all businesses are wanting to make millions, if not more, and this idea of being rich is what people want. And so it's really hard to kind of battle against that. And I think the solution is actually supporting local. So it's this whole think global, act local thing, which is really important, because ultimately that's where we can avoid monopolies. That's where we can avoid mass production of anything, because, you know, kind of like that question you had at the beginning, you know, if you were to buy meat from a little farm in Scotland versus a massive ranch somewhere else, whether it's in North or South America, like, one of those is a mass production, not much care for economics or environment, versus probably a local family, you know, taking care of the land that they have because it's all they have. And I'm trying not to romanticize it too much, but I think it is important to say that actually the future of food being sustainable is more small than it is big. And I think it's kind of up to us to start opting in for that, to say, well, actually, what is local to me? What can I support that isn't going to become a global monopoly and isn't going to take it? I mean, the classic example is this Oatly story that keeps unfolding, which is, you know, a very small, entrepreneurial, sustainable business who were slowly becoming a household name, in my opinion, decided to make a poor choice for the environment by taking funding from a company, from an investment firm that is unsustainable and that has ties elsewhere. And just, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, it's been released that they are now Starbucks's new partner. And you think, so the reason you wanted to do that was not to become sustainable or bring oat milk to places that didn't have it before to be more sustainable. You wanted to become a monopoly and you wanted to take up that opportunity, and to do that you needed this investment. And so it's really clear what that plan was, whereas the local little oat milk glass company that's going to trundle along to Glasgow to drop, I want to support them because they're not trying to monopolize the world. They're trying to bring an option right to me. They've listened to the voices of consumers. You know, I didn't say I wanted Oatly to be in Starbucks. I said I wanted oat milk and not to feel guilty about the packaging. Oatly didn't do that. This little brand did. And so I think it's important for us to really hold accountable the businesses that say they're sustainable but don't practice what they preach. Yeah. And then when we do find a business that does, we move our money there.
Nice. I guess it's almost like a catch-22 where you support the local business when they're small, but then suddenly they get really big, and the idea, like you said, everyone just wants to make money. And at that point, it goes downhill and they become a big capitalist company. And you're like, oh, okay, now I have to find money another small business and start again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's hard. And I know there are big companies that will, that may try to stay sustainable, but I guess the bigger you get, it gets harder and harder almost for them to keep up with the demand. I guess one last question before we like do the final thoughts. So I guess one of the biggest things that I always think about with about veganism is like, am I a single individual having an impact by cutting out meat and dairy and eggs, or is the, or does that not matter in the long scheme of things? When there's like, isn't there the thing where it's like five companies in the world are responsible for 90% of the emissions? So is me being vegan actually having an impact?
Yeah, do you know, I feel I get asked this question all the time, just about individual actions, like, do they matter? I think partly just depending on the day, I'll probably have a different answer to this. Sometimes you feel really defeatist and you feel like, actually, no, what I do doesn't matter. And, you know, there's big investments happening and, you know, I can't stop that. But then equally, we know that because individuals have made lifestyle changes, whether that is cutting out meat and dairy, whether that is something to do with plastic, whether that is deciding to get rid of their car, like whatever that is, you're ultimately making, at least you're playing your part as just a responsible citizen. And I guess what I would challenge is anyone who thinks that it's not enough. You know, any big influential person in the world probably started out with no influence and have built that. But actually, as individuals, we have this sphere of influence that is way bigger than we ever think. And we can influence that. So your sphere of influence is like the people you live with, the people you work with, the people you spend time with, your friends, your family. You've then got colleagues. You've then maybe got a sports team, or you're in a club, or you've got social media. You guys have a podcast. You know, you have a sphere of influence where people are watching and listening what you do. That begins to change their habits, like me going into the bathroom and seeing my flatmate with a bamboo toothbrush. Things just happen around you. But actually what's going to happen is at different points of everyone's lives, you're going to be in moments where you have other influential people around you, or maybe you have an opportunity to make a difference or a change. And so part of it is, you know, I don't believe that by me on my own making changes, I'm going to change the planet. That's not how it works, and that's not my goal. My goal, you know, speaking to people, is not to say I'm doing really well, isn't that great? It's actually to be like, come with me, journey with me, let's do this together. And so I guess part of it is like, we need to not have a defeatist attitude, because if everyone thought it's not enough, then nothing would ever get done.
Yeah.
Equally, we just need to remember that exactly that. I think it's 100 companies make up 71% of global emissions, like globally around the world. That's massive. And that is a very select few companies, but those companies are made up of people. Those people have families, those people have friends and colleagues and social media, and slowly you could begin to influence them. You know, you could drip feed into them. You know, BP and Shell have CEOs. I really hope one of their children becomes a climate activist, because that will have such a huge impact. I hope that a teacher at their child's school decides to do a session on climate change and look at... So you can see how you can start to really build that. And so I think when it comes to sustainable diets, it's actually, you know, the places that, so you guys are both part of institutions. Those institutions will have eating establishments, you know, those are places that you can influence. And I know that that's, you know, there's been tons of things like university students asking their university to only provide local food that can be found, you know, in the regions that they're in, or if they could decide to cut out meat one day a week, or whether they could. And actually, these are conversations that can have impacts bigger than you could ever do on an individual scale. But that's part of what we need to see. And I guess part of it is just being able to live that out and say, well, actually, I'm going to live it out. I'm going to lead by influence and lead by example, and make a big impact in somewhere else.
Yeah. I think it's allowing yourself to think that as well. Like, I always beat myself up because I can't change the water by clicking my fingers. And it's those small actions are making a difference. Actually, I'll shout out to my gran who listens to every episode, but she like never wastes a drop of food. And I was on the phone to her the other day, and I don't even know what I said. Oh, I said, I get this veg box and one of the veg is going off, so I need to think about what to cook with a turnip, like who uses turnip these days. And she went, Amy, food waste is one of the worst things for the climate. And I was like, yes. So here we go. It does work. So for our final thoughts, someone had asked us on our page, why do you think people are so reluctant to try veganism? And I guess there's lots of different answers, but you know, there's some people that are just very against it. What do you think the main thing is driving that?
I think it's just difference. You know, difference, we can either embrace it and find it exciting, or we can find it alienating and we can feel like we're being held to account for something, or we're being blamed for something. And part of it is that. And I guess I've always lived in Scotland, and our heritage is farming. You know, it's one of the oldest professions. It's something that is, you know, upheld our country. And so I think there's a lot of tradition in it. And I think there's a lot of not wanting to hurt people's feelings. You know, I live near a greenbelt. A lot of my friends work in agriculture or have been grown up around it. And so part of it is just not wanting to really embrace that change. And so I think part of it is doing that. But I think other than that, I think it's important to realise that veganism is not yet that accessible, and one of the gaps that needs to be bridged is education of food. because I didn't know how to cook an artichoke or what to do with soybeans or what, you know, and that is a genuine gap. I'm sort of tongue-in-cheek about it, but that is a genuine thing that needs to be discussed, because if we're mm-hmm. going to move away from the kind of meat, potato and two veg, what do people do with tofu? That's a genuine question. And it's not, you know, we don't want to assume that people know what to do with that. And we need to be really helpful in that. And we need to make sure that people know what they're doing with that. And, you know, I think we just need to make the conversation a really like happy and healthy one, and saying actually, like, let's embrace some of this difference. Let's encourage people to see what's local to them and seasonal to them, and really excite people with the food choices that we have. And so I think that's where we just need to really embrace it. But I think people are just a bit defensive because it's different, but also because we all probably know someone who is militant about this and who is quite aggressive, and they're passionate, and that's a good thing. And we just need to turn that passion for everyone into a really constructive conversation for both the energy of that activist, let's save them, you know, like let's turn that, but also just to really encourage people along with us.
Yeah.
And I guess my next question was, I think one of the things with veganism, and especially now that brands have taken it on, is that it's always the more expensive option to get the vegan item or the organic or whatever they've labeled it as. It's always the more expensive option compared to just getting, you know, off brand or even like Tesco brand or Sainsbury's brand. So how could one approach veganism who's like on a budget and doesn't have the access to buy that every single time? So what is like the first step if someone wants to give it a go? How would that work? Because or even the time to, you know, compost, or even something as simple as like separating your recycling or any of that, like how accessible is it to everyone, and how do you make it accessible to everyone?
Yeah, well, there's two cookbooks I'm going to recommend because I think they're great ones. And it was ones that myself and my flatmate sort of worked our way through, and one that I've done with my family. So the first one is the £1 meal series. So this guy does these £1 meals, and he has a £1 meal vegan book. It's very much the basics. Obviously, the idea is that these meals are £1, so it's accessible and it's cheap. And none of the ingredients are like wacky things you've never heard of.
Oh, you good.
Know, stuff that you're like, where am I supposed to find that in Glasgow? Like, okay. So that's a great one, especially because it's basic, but like delicious food. And the other one is a book called Vegan-ish in brackets. And it is by Jack Munro. And they have done many different books on cooking and come from a background of economic deprivation. And so they're an absolute advocate for really transforming the world of cuisine and cooking and home cooking and education and making it accessible. And so those two books, the £1 meal vegan one and Vegan-ish by Jack Munro, are some really good ones because they are brilliant cooking, delicious, and we have staples that we have every week now. We're sort of like, oh, let's have that again, it's so good. But it really battles that accessibility by using ingredients they've heard of, that you know of, that you can get in a supermarket. None of the meals take forever because that I don't have time for that, and they're all reasonably priced. And I think those are two of the best places that I've been able to really engage with that conversation well, and yeah, they're the best ones.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, I honestly feel sometimes when I get home from the lab at night too tired to think about what I'm cooking. So having something like that sounds like a good idea. So we have one last question, and that is, if someone could do one thing, just if they're having a totally unsustainable life, one thing to make themselves more sustainable today, what would it be?
Well, I'm going to go with a food one to stay kind of on topic. And I'm raging because your gran's totally like stolen the thunder out of this. But maybe someone listening to this was hoping for a yes or no answer and is a bit raging that I've given a bit of waffly answers to everything. But the worst food for the environment is the food you don't eat. So reducing food waste is probably one of the most important things we could do. So globally, a third of food is wasted. That's wasted because farm standards, because we don't buy it in the supermarkets, or because the worst one, we leave it to rot in our homes. And if food waste was a country, it would be the third largest emitter of carbon. Wow. So food waste is a huge problem, and we can all play our part with that. And so I would just encourage people to think about it And a couple of like tips within that is like, think about being creative with your food waste in the same way that you had to find something to do with the turnip. Like, don't let stuff go to waste. Be really proactive with it. Soups and smoothies are your best friends for when it comes to like fruit and veg. You can make breadcrumbs with stale bread. You can even use vegetable scraps to make stock. You can turn coffee grounds into slug repellent. You can do banana peels and make fertilizer, or you can even fry it up in barbecue sauce, and it is pretty good. But like, think about your food waste and think about the way that you can be creative with it. But also, one of the best tips I had was, especially now that I'm back at home for the pandemic, I've returned home, it's been great. We now have more adults in the house, so we have more food. And one of the things that kept happening was you would open the fridge, rummage around because you can actually see everything, and realize, that's gone out of date. I forgot we bought that. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you've left food to go out of date. It happens to everyone, and it's stuff that genuinely is like growing arms and legs, you can't put it in the freezer. And so one of the things that we've done is we actually have a section in the fridge where it's dedicated to stuff that's like about to go out of date. So it's like, maybe you used half of a pepper in a recipe or half a jar or something, it goes straight onto that because we know it's about to go out of date. So whoever's cooking dinner, you know, whatever's on that shelf, you need to somehow incorporate it. Sometimes that's fun, sometimes it's annoying. But actually, it was really helpful because it means that, I mean, I worked in a restaurant and we had to do like stock rotation. You had to keep moving. And like, you forget this stuff when you live in a house. So have spaces in your house, like do audits, make sure you know what food you've got, because ultimately, like, that's a huge way that we can save emissions. And then of course, as has already been said, like any food you do have that is wasted or scraps, compost it. Like, find a bit of garden space, find a local allotment that might take some of your food waste, buy an indoor wormery. Like, there's so many cool ways that you can get rid of it. And so, yeah, but food waste, your gran is totally on it with it. Yeah, food waste.
The grans have all the good tips.
They do.
I actually need to like work on my food waste because I used to just use the council bins, but now they've stopped doing them, so I'm like back to square one. So I'm going to look into composting. Actually, I live in a flat, so I don't know if I can do anything in the garden, but yeah, I'll need to look into that.
We had a composter in my old, it was a house that we lived in with, I lived in with three other people, and one of my flatmates got like the compost thing, and it was, emptying it out was the bane of all of our existences because it would start leaking juice almost.
Oh, and it stung.
And we were all like, get it out of here. But we were like, it's good for the environment, but I hate this so much.
Yeah,
it's the sacrifices that you make.
Absolutely.
If we've finished the questions now, but if you do, you think we've missed anything vital that you'd want to throw in?
I think so. I took little notes with all your questions. I was like, oh, I can prepare, but I think we pretty much covered everything.
Cool.
That was really, really helpful.
Yes.
I feel
braver approaching my journey.
Yeah.
I've always been scared because I'm just like, I can't do this. It's like, it's daunting. But I'm also one of those people that doesn't like doing things halfway. I either do it or I don't. Yeah. So I think that's part of the reason why I'm just like, I'm not going to do it because I can't go fully vegan just yet. I'm not ready.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's the baby steps that matter.
Yeah. And don't worry about not having a clear answer. Most of these podcasts, our answers have been yes, no, maybe. So
that's all the theme.
Yeah. So it just worked very well for us.
Great.
Thank you so much.
It's been so fun.
Thank you.
Lovely to meet you. And we might call you back for a recycling one then, if that's what you love talking about.
That honestly, I could go on a rant about recycling. It's so good.
I
love it.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, I'm excited to hear about the recycling. I've always been suspicious of recycling. So when you said that, I was like, yes.
It's like, yeah, you've left us on a cliffhanger. Like, come back for the next episode.
But yes, but thank you for coming on.
You're so welcome. No worries.
Well, thank you
so much.
No worries. Nice to meet you both. Enjoy
your
time.
Take care.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye.
Well, that was our interview with Laura. I learned lots. I hope you did too. Have you decided any changes you want to make?
I'm getting a bamboo toothbrush.
Okay.
I've been considering it for a while. And then Laura brought it up and I was like, that's a sign. Sorry, about food as well. It's just being more conscious about my food waste. And actually now I do get the reduced stuff and now I just mm-hmm. feel a bit better about it. But yeah, just being conscious about using all the food, because I am someone who's just like, oh, it's been a while now. Let me just chuck it away. It's okay. But now I'll force myself to do something with it.
Be creative, make soups.
Exactly. And yours is also food waste?
So, yeah. Like, I'm not vegan. I don't know what I am. I think I would just call myself like a flexitarian because I've just kind of cut down on things. And
oh, yeah, I need to cut out meat as well. Yes.
Yeah, I don't really, like, I've never really enjoyed many types of meat. Mm-hmm. So I've always been slightly vegetarian. I enjoy some, like, yeah, it was easy for me to become more vegan or more plant-based because I don't really like meat products anyway. So that's not an issue. My biggest issue is I'm lazy in the kitchen. I don't have the time, the energy, or the creativity to cook. Actually, I do have the time. I just settle for something really easy.
I don't want to use the time for that, though.
Exactly. I have better things to do in my life.
But you generally don't like cooking.
So. I don't enjoy it yet. So, but I do often buy things and think I'll eat that and then never do. Mm-hmm. And it's, I like the idea that Laura said about the fridge, the to-go fridge shelf. I'm going to start that and then just force myself to do things with the random vegetables which are on their way out. And yeah, I'm going to think, I don't know if I think about like a compost bin for the house, but I think there's like
it's hard because we're both in flats, aren't we?
I know. Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest. But you have like, not a private, but a private garden in the back of the building.
I don't think I'm allowed to do anything because it's council, and the council, Glasgow City Council, used to have those grey bins where you could just chuck your food waste into.
Okay.
But they've stopped it for some reason, and I think it's now they've made, maybe it's because
I can hear the TV in the back.
Sorry, I'll shut the door. Forgot to shut the door. This Glasgow City Council used to have those grey bins for food waste, but they've stopped doing them where I live, and I don't know why. I think it's more like you have to walk somewhere. I think it's a pandemic.
But you want to walk with food waste.
I know. But if you just have like a big bag of it and it's one trip and the people walk by will never see you again, so it's okay if you smell
it. It's okay. You're just going to smell like trash.
Yes. But there must be ways about it. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We'll find a way.
Yes. And I think it's also fun, like hopefully post-pandemic, we used to have those potlucks, remember? We would all make food and bring them. Maybe we could like host, like do a sustainable potluck and see what people bring.
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm so excited to have people over.
I know.
We're recording this on the day when they've just told us that in a month we might be able to go to a cafe. So it's very exciting. Also very sad that we're like, ooh, cafe in a month. But very exciting.
It's true. It's true.
But yeah, and like Laura said, it's not really a black and white thing. So even though our question was, should we all go vegan? The answer is yes, no, or maybe, mm-hmm. as usual. But yeah, it's more about just being more conscious about your choices and doing what's right within your price range, your lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And just being more conscious.
Yeah. And like, I don't know if this has been ongoing for a while when I like beat myself up about things I can't control, but I'm going to like give myself a break and not overthink everything I eat. Like with the banana situation, Laura was thinking, I do that too, so I need to not.
Well, to be fair, like you're doing well. Like when Laura said she's that influence on her friends, I'm like, you're known as the person who's environmentally conscious.
I know, but then I have my dips.
Yeah, but like you're allowed to have dips, I think.
Actually, like, it was a big thing in lockdown where they stopped taking takeaway cups. Not the takeaway cups, like, you take your cup to the cafe and they put the coffee in it and they stopped it.
You put it on your Insta story, uh-huh. You put a disclaimer being like, by the way, I do not get cups from cafes. It's just not allowed. I tried.
It was about 6 months I went without it. Like, I always had my cup at the ready and then the bloody pandemic ruined that. But there's some cafes that are now accepting them again.
I was just going to ask, like, are they doing it now? Because I haven't taken mine in forever because I'm just like, it's not. And I love taking it because you get slightly more coffee. They do fill it up nice. And you get a discount, like 20p yeah. off, so it works out. So hopefully in a month and 10 days, we can...
We sit down and drink a coffee in a real mug.
Imagine in a real that. Mug instead of paper mugs.
I'm sure we've got listeners who aren't in the UK and are like, have they gone
what
crazy?
Is wrong with you?
No, it's just we live in an extreme lockdown.
We've just tasted hope and it tastes great, but it might be taken away from us any second. So we're going to enjoy it as much as possible. Even more so than the actual cafes opening. I'm just going to sit in this hope and be like, we're almost there.
We're getting there. There's light at the end.
Yes. But yes, thank you for listening to our episode.
Your ramblings.
Oh, I was going to mention while Laura was talking, I think it was useful for people to know as well, in terms of like being creative with your dishes and like using stuff that you never thought you'd use, Max Lamana Instagram is really good with that. I think he made pancakes with coffee grounds before and has made like used banana peel for actual food. So he's really good for inspiration. I don't do a lot of it, I'm not going to lie, but that's mostly because I don't have coffee grounds at home. And a lot of the stuff, again, is those specific ingredients that you don't have lying around sometimes, but vegans do. But some of them are actually really useful. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're in the situation, just knowing that that exists, you're like, oh, I saw that somewhere.
Yeah,
I
like
could do that.
The banana peel pulled pork thing.
Yes, yes.
I tried
another thing.
I tried the...
banana peel pancakes?
Grounds. No, coffee grounds. But
did you try them?
You need a particular coffee ground, and mine was the two big grounds.
Oh, no.
Like, they weren't fine. And I spent ages making them. And I was trying to eat them, and it was like chewing sand.
Oh, I mean, have zero luck with pancakes.
And I know that is a thing that I need to deal with. But I went back onto the Instagram and read the comments, and people were like, can I use this kind of coffee? And he was like, it's better to use fine coffee. And I'm like, aha, that's what I went
mine's
wrong.
Coarse.
Read the description, Amy.
It's the coffee that he probably uses for like an espresso machine kind of coffee. I have like cafetiere coffee, which
that does not
I
work.
Can see the clumps. I was like, oh no. Yeah, but another thing you can do with banana peel is make fertilizer. Didn't you do that? Or you sent me that?
And maybe sent you it. You can do that with like, if you boil vegetables, you can keep the water for your plants, which I've done. Because actually, I think it was an advert for IKEA or something. I never thought about this. And it was like someone in the advert was washing tomatoes. And then he poured that water into a jug and fed his plants because also
using
water
washed
waste.
Tomato water.
Oh, just that's because weird. It's like, it's not that dirty. Waste. Yeah, and it's watery as well. And it's just like, thinking about everything you use, how else can you use it?
Yeah.
Which is, it is difficult when you have grown up from your whole life, just throwing things out. Like, it is hard to adapt. But when you talk to people like your gran, they have always got ways because they lived in a generation where they would have to take Tupperware
use
to
all
like,
the
butchers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, use all the scraps. That's why things like soup were invented, you know, because they used things. But we don't, and it is difficult to get into that mindset.
Yeah, it's just baby steps, isn't it? And one step at a time, slowly, and incorporate. It's the thing where you're like, should I incorporate everything in one go? And everything that I do, how do I repurpose it? But you could just do one thing, and that
it gets overwhelming. I think I told you, I remember going to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and this, I think I was like, getting interested in climate change or like accepting it was something I had to change my lifestyle. I went to the Fringe Festival and I just looked at all the plastic cups and I came home and I cried for like a week over it. And my mum was like, what? And I was like, the plastic cups I contributed to it.
Even if you go to a beach or anything, all the plastic cups, you're like, you're killing the turtles.
I know. Actually, it was on Laura's Instagram, I seen that she'd done like litter picking. And she was taking pictures. Did you see this? Taking pictures of the dates on the plastic. And there was things in the 80s that she picked up on a beach. And I guess I'm going on a rant now. Here I go. But it's not just like, it's not just the fact that it's killing the ocean. Those plastics are made from fossil fuels.
Yes.
I think. And then if they're burned, they're also releasing carbon.
And they're killing the ocean, not just by existing as a plastic bottle. That plastic bottle gets not broken down, but like it physically broken, mm-hmm. and then gets ingested, and then ultimately that comes back to our food. So yeah. we're eating the plastic we throw away. So
the ultimate karma.
The ultimate karma, really. It's we're killing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nice existential crisis to have tonight, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think it'll be interesting to see like how things go in the future when it comes to even just like university courses. Like I think this will open up a whole range mm-hmm. of like understanding what things like plastic does to human bodies.
And figuring out that grey area, isn't it? Because nothing's black and white. We can't really just stop plastic completely to do that.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's also useful, and without plastics we would have other problems, and yes. plastics are sterile and they're needed in the hospitals. It's just that
Amy, the amount of plastic I got through today in the lab,
I know
I had to use, I think I got through like 150 Eppendorf tubes today and like yeah. 4 pipette boxes, and I was just like, I'm killing the planet.
There's some of those things we know that we need to do that.
Yeah, and like sterility. For me, I'm like, I'd rather, yeah, because like I could reuse a pipette tip, right? But then if I contaminate my samples, I have to do everything again. So I end up using double the tubes. So yeah. I'm like, just throw the pipette tip away and get a new one.
Well, there's, I don't know if there's any scientists listening. There's a Twitter, I think it's called like Green Labs something. I will link to it. But they are scientists, and they show you how to like reduce your waste in the lab, and it's things like we don't need to do this where we work. We can buy in a lot of the reagents, but if you're making up things like PBS, a lot of people make them in plastic bottles, but you can make that in a glass bottle and just send.
And we do it in glass bottles.
We do.
Yeah. And we reuse our glass bottles because we have to re-autoclave. Okay. Mm-hmm. We're doing something. And, okay.
And actually like what Laura said as well, like just who you talk to makes an impact, and we've spoken to people in our work, and they did end up changing some of the packaging that those falcons
the styrofoam,
remember and they're now using plastic racks that you can keep forever basically to use the chips in. So things do make a difference. It's just I think for me, remembering that small changes do work, I get very like hopeless over things quickly.
And it's just starting that conversation, isn't it? Where in the beginning it could be really awkward because they're like, why are you bringing this up? But it does make a difference. And honestly, those new racks are so much better than the styrofoam.
I've not got to use them yet.
Oh, yeah.
Next week.
Next week? Yeah. Cool. So Amy, if people want to find us on social media, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at This Is a Stupid Question But, on Twitter at TIASQB, and you can email us at thisisastupidquestionbut@gmail.com. And since we've talked a lot about other accounts in this episode, we'll link them all on our Instagram. So yes. you can
follow everyone. Yeah. Tune in 2 weeks' time for our next episode, which will be a surprise.
Not because it's extra exciting, just because we planned so far and then the plan stopped.
Basically Brian Cox never got back to us.
Who else did we message?
Jamila.
No, from the
her agent did get back to us and she's just busy.
Her agent will get in touch in the future, of course.
Stacey Dooley.
And who's the
Caroline Cox. Caroline from The Invisible Woman as well. Basically the celebrities didn't get back.
Yeah, basically aim too high. But you know, if you don't aim high, you aim low, and that ain't no way to live.
If you can't aim high, aim low.
You miss all the shots you don't take.
Yes, that's what she meant.
Is there any other inspirational quotes? Reach for the stars. Laugh. If you fall, you'll fall with stardust. You know,
reach for the moon. Land among the stars. I think, but yeah, it's gonna be a surprise while we figure out that the fact that Amy and I are gonna have to sit down and do research again. And we can have lovely experts coming on and telling us and answering our stupid questions for
if you're
us.
An expert,
please get in touch.
Volunteer as tribute.
But yeah, so we'll see you then. Bye.